Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, 40 years in 40 days, as development agencies mark the anniversary of Pope Paul VI's landmark encyclical, we discover a virtual vigil to help put faith into practice this Lenten season. Looking ahead to International Women's Day, we find out how the feminization of poverty means higher risks for HIV/AIDS infections. But first, Pope Benedict focuses on the essential value of prayer at his Sunday Angelus address. Welcome to the programme. On the second Sunday of Lent, Pope Benedict spoke about the central place of prayer in the Christian life, thanking all those who had accompanied him with their prayers during the past week of spiritual exercises here in the Vatican. Speaking to those who gathered in St. Peter's Square for his Angelus address, the Pope drew inspiration for his reflections from this week's Gospel account of Christ's transfiguration. My colleague Lydia O'Kane takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
In his first Angelus address following a week of spiritual exercises, Pope Benedict focused on the power of prayer.
La preghiera non è un accessorio, un optional.
The Holy Father said prayer was not an optional or an accessory for Christians, but a question of life and death. He went on to say only those who pray and those who entrust themselves to God with the love of a child can enter eternal life.
Today, Gospel invites us to ponder the mystery of Christ's transfiguration, to acknowledge him as incarnate Son of God, and to follow him along the way that leads to the saving mystery of his cross and the resurrection.
Using the example of Christ, who in Sunday's Gospel climbs the mount to pray to his Father, Pope Benedict says that by entering into an intimate dialogue with his Father, Christ does not try to evade or escape the mission to which he was put on earth. The Holy Father goes on to say it is through this intimate dialogue with his Father that Christ enters more deeply into his mission, which he knows will force him to pass through the pains of the cross. In this way, Christ shows us that prayer means to unite oneself to God's will.
Pregare non è evadere dalla realtà.
Pope Benedict said, for a Christian, praying does not mean evading or escaping reality and its responsibilities, but facing them fully, confiding in the faithful and inexhaustible love of the Lord.
A tutti voi auguro una buona domenica, una buona settimana.
The Pope then wished the pilgrims from across the world a happy and peaceful Sunday in a number of languages, including English.
During this Lenten season, may you grow closer to the Lord in prayer, and may he shed the light of his face upon you and your families.
My thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report on Pope Benedict's Angelus address this past Sunday. Now, if you're looking for some thought-provoking ideas to help you pray and practice your gospel values this Lenten season, why not take a look online at the website of CAFOD, the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. CAFOD has set up a 40-day virtual vigil to mark the 40th anniversary of Pope Paul VI's great encyclical on development and social justice, Populorum Progressio. Inspired by the prophetic vision contained in that document, CAFOD is running a Live Simply project, urging each one of us to examine our own lifestyles and live in a more sustainable way in solidarity with the poor. The 40-day vigil includes a daily reflection and prayer, plus a chance to sign up to a series of online promises that combat the consumer mentality and bring real benefits to people in the developing world as well. To find out more, my colleague Susie Hodges spoke to CAFOD's Justice Spirituality Facilitator, Susie Bruard.
Well, it really came about through the Live Simply Challenge, that we wanted people to be involved in Live Simply, and we wanted people to pray. And so we decided to create a virtual vigil that anyone who uses the web would be able to log on to. And on it, there's some reflection, some prayerful reflection. And also, each day chooses one year between 1967 and the present day and focuses on that year, what was happening in the world and what was also happening in CAFOD's own history.
This month marks the 40th anniversary since the encyclical Populorum Progressio was published. How much relevance does the message of this encyclical still have today, and how does it impact upon CAFOD and its work?
Well, I think it's extremely relevant for today. In fact, Tina Beattie, a theologian from England, said in the Tablet a few weeks ago that the encyclical seems today even more relevant than when it was written. And the reason is because the subjects that it deals with, that it talks about, are still pertinent today. So it talks about development being more than economic growth. It talks about the fact that God has made the earth and all that it contains for all to share. That true peace goes hand in hand with justice, and that education is the most powerful weapon to change the world. So I think all those things are relevant today for everyone, that everyone is responsible for the world that we live in. And of course, it's very much influenced CAFOD's work.
Do many people think that, in fact, Populorum Progressio was, in fact, very prophetic in what it said?
It was certainly extremely prophetic in what it said. And if I can just give you an example, one of the questions that Pope Paul VI asked is that each person must examine their conscience, and we must ask ourselves, are we prepared to pay more for the imported goods so that the foreign producer may make a fairer profit? Now, bearing in mind, he wrote this 25 years before the Fair Trade Foundation was set up. So nowadays we're used to hearing about fair trade products, and I hope that many of us buy fair trade products if we're able to. But this was 25 years before the Fair Trade Foundation was even set up. So I think the document is extremely prophetic and challenging.
Coming back to this 40-day virtual vigil, what criteria was used in drawing up the prayers and reflections?
What it wanted to do was combine prayer with facts so people could reflect. Then they were led to a promise, a suggestion for a promise that they could make, particularly during Lent, and then some facts, some world facts, and some facts about CAFOD's history. So I think it was the combination of those four things that went into the making of the vigil.
Are there any ones which are particularly thought-provoking?
For instance, on day 18 during Lent, one of the facts is that CAFOD helped facilitate a pastoral visit by Cardinal Hume to Ethiopia, and the visit had a real profound impression on him. And he then, if you like, asked the UK government to change their policy towards the emergency in Ethiopia. And then the promise for that day is we're trying to encourage people to share a simple lunch once a month with their work colleagues and to save what they would have spent on that lunch to give to CAFOD.
Coming back to this Live Simply campaign, this is in many ways in direct contrast to today's Western society. You know, it's very consumeristic. We're encouraged to earn more and more. And so we can then consume on an ever larger scale, isn't it?
Yes. Bishop Michael Evans, the Bishop of East Anglia, has talked about something called affluenza, which is an epidemic of overconsumption, waste, pollution and stress, which threatens the whole of life. And I think we are a society in the Western world which is often consumed by consumerism and impoverished by wealth. And we can be caught in what Pope Paul VI calls soul-stifling materialism. I think Live Simply is countercultural in that it asks people to take time to reflect, not to just think about their immediate needs, but also to discern between needs and wants. So in that sense, it's countercultural. But I think also we cannot ignore the fact that nowadays people are really looking at the whole area of sustainability. And in that sense, it's going with the culture, a culture which is saying, actually, we know that we use too many plastic bags. We know that we consume too much energy, and we would like to do something about it.
And so far, how many individuals and organisations have signed up to Live Simply and made promises?
So far, 41 different organisations have signed up to be Live Simply members of the network, because Live Simply is not just CAFOD, but as I say, 41 different organisations from across England and Wales. This includes dioceses that have said they are Live Simply dioceses, and different and diverse organisations such as Charismatic Renewal, the Catholic Education Service, the Catholic Youth Service. So they've all signed up to be Live Simply members. And then on our website, the CAFOD website and the Live Simply website, there's a chance for ordinary individuals and parishes to sign up to promises. And these promises are as diverse as the people that are making them. So there are many promises around praying, and there are other promises that are practical and talk about recycling, turning off computers and televisions. Some promises are around actually promoting Live Simply. So there's a whole spectrum of promises. People can sign up to the CAFOD ones, they can sign up to the ones on the Live Simply network, or if they want to, they can create their own promise. And the way they do that is by saying that they will do whatever it is they pledge to do, but they want other people to join them in that. So we hope that it will create a sense of community.
But do you have any idea about numbers?
Well, so far there have been over 500 promises made, but obviously some people have made more than one promise. But we're really hoping, we're really pushing this during Lent, because we think Lent is a time of reflection and a time when people will feel moved to make promises.
Have there been any particularly unusual or colourful promises?
Some of them are around sharing water and what have you, or using water for washing up and for bathing and all the rest of it. So I think there have been a few unusual ones. I think some have been challenging. Some people are promising not to, for instance, take a plane for a year for personal use. So I think those are perhaps more challenging ones. Some people have promised in particular to help certain parts of the developing world. So I think there's a promise, for instance, about helping people in Sierra Leone. So there's some direct ones, but what we're hoping really is that all the promises will help those who live in poverty, because the changes that we make in our lifestyles will have a direct impact on the world globally. We want people to take the time to reflect. So we don't want people just to go straight into the action, but to take time to reflect, to discern, what is it that God is calling me to? What do I need to do? We're not all called to do the same thing. We realize that for most people in this world, materially speaking, they don't have a choice about living simply. So living simply can be taken on a material way, can be taken in a material way, but can also be looked at as doing simple things, not always looking to externals, if you like, to make us happy.
Susie Hodges talking there to CAFOD's Justice Spirituality Facilitator, Susie Bruard. International Women's Day is marked in countries around the world on March the 8th each year, a chance to celebrate improvements in women's rights and the achievements of those who have battled against discrimination of all kinds. But it's also a time to reflect on new concerns, in particular the feminization of poverty, a complex phenomenon linked to persistent discrimination against women in areas of education, healthcare, decision-making or community life. In India, for example, a new report shows that in poor rural parts of the country, less than half of all women have even heard of the AIDS epidemic, making them especially vulnerable to HIV infection. India has the highest number of AIDS cases per country in the world, and with illiteracy rates for women around 50%, there are real fears for an explosion of the disease unless more work is done on education and prevention.
I think it's very important to continue to promote voluntary testing and counseling. I think people have to be motivated to be tested for HIV. And as they're motivated, and if they're counseled properly, then you also have the chance to educate them about the ways to prevent the spread of the virus if they're not infected, and also about the ways to get help and prevent spreading to someone else if they are infected.
Father Bob Vitillo is Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Global Confederation of Catholic Aid and Development Agencies, Caritas Internationalis. He told me that while some Indian government officials are keen to promote enforced HIV testing, the Church is focusing more on voluntary tests, education and counselling to combat the spread of this pandemic.
Most of the psychology experts tell us that you really don't motivate people to change behaviour by forcing them to do something. And, you know, there are plenty of old studies with mice and rats and even with people that show that forced behaviour doesn't work in changing behaviour and making more positive behaviors. So I think that's very true also for HIV testing. And I do think it's an abuse of human rights to force testing on people or to have a whole population tested or even to identify certain groups and say these groups are more likely to be infected, so they should be tested and not others. One of the issues that's coming up in the public health field today is that they're talking about routine opt-out testing. And they're saying that's not forced testing, but doctors, instead of having to go through the trouble of convincing people to be tested or counseling them, doctors could just let people know that everybody's going to be tested when they go in for a physical. And if they don't want to be, then they should tell us. And I have to say, I think there's some strong ethical implications in that as well. There's a real power relationship between doctor and patient. So many patients are afraid to say, I don't want to be tested, if the doctor says we test everyone, for one thing. And again, to miss that important element of counseling people, I think, is a big mistake that some of the medical professionals are promoting today.
This is an issue that we're talking about regarding India. Now, of course, India is one of the key areas, isn't it, expected to rise to perhaps even some of the levels of sub-Saharan African AIDS infections and cases.
Yes, well, what I was just talking about, the routine opt-out testing, is something that's being promoted pretty much generally now in most parts of the world. And in fact, the World Health Organization is now putting out some guidelines that they're asking for comments on. So that will be a more global approach to things. On India, yes, it is an area that we have great fear about. Right now, there are about 5 million people living with HIV, as far as we know it. It's the largest country in the world next to South Africa in terms of number of people living with HIV in one country. Of course, India is a very big country. It's really a subcontinent. But also, there have been some strong movements in India to demand testing of people before they're married. And here, too, I don't think the approach should be that you force people into that. In the United States, two states had that kind of policy. And what happened was that the number of marriages in those states went down very quickly, and the number of marriages in the neighboring states went up very quickly. So people just found ways around that. Plus, to insist that people be tested before marriage and then say, we're not going to allow you to be married, doesn't stop them from having sexual contact or even from living together. So I don't think that's the best approach. Some bishops' conferences, especially the bishops of Burundi, have put in a policy to raise the issue of HIV with all candidates for marriage and to ask them to go and get a voluntary test and to share the results with each other. Not a matter of bringing it to the priest or the priest deciding he's not going to officiate at your wedding based on an HIV test result, but really to strongly encourage people to think about this issue in their lives, in their intimate relationships, as they prepare for marriage, and then to be sure that they share those results with each other. I think that's probably a much more balanced approach than to force people to be tested before they're married.
Above all, encouraging a relationship of trust, in other words.
A relationship of trust and more openness and getting people, as they're preparing for marriage, to discuss sexual issues. Sometimes they don't do that, even though they're preparing for a life of a sexual relationship, among other aspects of their relationship.
The question about also government leaders and whether it's appropriate for them to be having mandatory testing or not is something we hear about quite a lot. We've seen it recently in South Africa, this question of whether presidents, prime ministers and so on should be tested to give an example to others, in other words, not to be afraid of this.
Yes, I think that there's an important value of some leaders standing up and saying, OK, I'm willing to be tested. And especially if you have some government leaders who are living with the virus, to talk about it and show that they could both live with the virus and still be leaders and still be integrated into the community. There's a very famous judge in South Africa, Edwin Cameron, who's been he's a Supreme Court judge and been very, very open about his living with the virus. And I think it's brought some hope to people with AIDS, and it's also, I hope, discouraged stigmatization of people with AIDS. So I think there's a witness value of that. But I do think we should always respect people's individual dignity and their choice in terms of privacy issues. Sometimes activists in the field feel like everybody should be tested and be open about the results. And some people want to deal with those things in a private way and with their trusted confidants. And I think we have to respect that, but also see the witness value of some leaders in the community talking about their situation.
This is an issue for the church as well, isn't it, regarding those applying, for example, to seminaries and so on?
Well, there are some, I understand that there are some dioceses and religious orders that, again, may ask candidates to think about HIV and also to consider having a test. Again, that's something that's up to the individual religious superiors and the bishops. But I think more importantly, we should be sure that we speak about HIV issues as we're forming seminarians and religious, not only for consideration of their own past histories, but also to prepare them to be very pastoral and sensitive in their approach to others.
These are all very difficult and very sensitive issues in a way. It's almost as though the scientific community, if you like, is looking for some kind of quick fix to this pandemic.
I think the scientific and the public health community and civil society in general has always been looking for a quick fix. And if we learned anything during these past 25 years, we should see that this is a very complex virus. It changes even in individuals, let alone in being spread to many members of the human family. It's a very complex pandemic. It's not just a medical problem. It's very much related to social conditions, to injustices, to economic and gender imbalances. And so there is no quick fix. I think we have to find many different approaches to try to reduce the number of infections, the new infections, to address the needs of those already infected, and then to continue our scientific research to, in the hope that someday we'll be able to find a vaccine or a cure to for this problem.
In the public perception, it's often seen that despite all the work that you do, that Caritas and that other church organisations all around the world do, it's often seen that the church has somehow kept its distance. It hasn't been engaged enough in what is one of the most pressing challenges, remains a pressing challenge even after these 25 years.
Yes, I think this is a very false image of the church. And I still meet government officials and United Nations officials who are shocked when I tell them about the range of church services in response. And also, I find that many of them are under very false impressions and thinking that leaders of our church or other churches have condemned people with HIV and AIDS. There have been a few small voices among some people, mostly non-Catholic religious leaders, who have talked about AIDS being God's punishment. But most of the faith-based communities don't say that and have really promoted compassionate, non-judgmental response. And yet, I think you're right, the officials, both in the sciences and the healthcare professions and even in government and civil society in general, get the impression, especially from some media sources, that the church is just blocking work on HIV and AIDS. I just recently completed a best practice study of the church's response to AIDS in Southern Africa. It was published on World AIDS Day by UNAIDS, the United Nations Coordinating Agency on AIDS Work Throughout the World. And, you know, I felt very privileged to interview people responding to the AIDS pandemic in Southern Africa, religious sisters especially, but also priests and lay people, and especially people living with AIDS whose lives have been prolonged, and then they get involved in working in these church-based programs on AIDS. It's a wonderful witness, and yet the story isn't told enough, so I felt grateful to be able to tell this story. One quick vignette. I found in my work a young child, 9 years old, Bongani, in the Diocese of Rustenburg, the diocese that's headed by Bishop Kevin Dowling, who's been a real prophet in this area. And this child was dying. They didn't give him more than a few weeks to live. And suddenly, we were able to get him antiretroviral medications. And his parents were also very seriously ill. All three of them are now on the medications. He's back in school, the young child, and he serves as the monitor for his parents to make sure that they're taking their medications every day.
So a great story of hope.
Exactly, and it's only because of the church is reaching out. These people live in a poor community, rural, no access to health care, and it's only the church that goes out into these slums and poor communities and makes sure that they can set up the clinics and the dispensaries and then set up the community volunteer programming to monitor people on their medications and to get them the medications.
And my thanks there to Father Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Global Confederation of Catholic Aid and Development Agencies, Caritas Internationalis. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget, you can always find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.